This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a local grant program aimed to help landowners and agriculturalists get the most out of their acreage.
The main focus in this case is greenhouse gas reduction and water conservation on your property.
And a Central Coast artist is trying to create a gig economy for local artists to help them find more paying work and inspire others to make art at the same time.
If you see me in my progress, in my process, and think that you can do this too, good. Go do it.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 25th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. First up, do you know what a Resource Conservation District, or RCD, is? They are organizations focused on helping landowners make the most of their resources, and much of the work of the RCD in Templeton is with vineyards and agriculturalists in northern San Luis Obispo County. RCDs serve as a bridge between government agencies like the California Department of Food and Agriculture and farmers and vineyard owners. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart to get the lowdown on the district's latest grant opportunities and projects.
I'm here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Andrew Johnson. I work for the Upper Salinas Los Tablos Resource Conservation District in Templeton. We have a district that covers the vast majority of San Luis Obispo County, and resource conservation districts are in place in order to help landowners with their resource conservation in general, land and water and air resources. We typically are working with agriculturalists in the area, and again, typically with vineyard operators, because that's the vast majority of our agriculture industry in northern San Luis Obispo County.
Okay, got it. Are you a government, like a government agency?
We are an unfunded mandate. So we occupy a nebulous space kind of in between the government and the people on the ground. Resource conservation districts came to pass after the Dust Bowl era as the Natural Resource Conservation Service was formed. There was a need for the local people to have a bit of a nexus between the federal government. Oftentimes, landowners prefer to work with resource conservation districts as opposed to the Natural Resource Conservation Service because they're more familiar. We also have a lot more flexibility within our programs.
Interesting. I don't know any of that history. I had no idea about that. Okay. And so tell me, like, describe a typical day for me. What do you do?
Well, anybody can walk in our doors. We are available for offering assistance with anything really having to do with natural resources. We've had people coming in to discuss the biodigester in San Luis Obispo. That was a very exciting project. We also have quite a few return customers. So vineyard operators are very common up in northern San Luis Obispo County. So we offer mobile irrigation lab services in order to do irrigation efficiency tests. We do quite a bit of grant writing. We have several substantial project partners with whom we have grants through the California Department of Food and Agriculture, some that are just beginning now, dealing with healthy soils. The state has a mandate for healthy soils programs, and there's quite a bit of funding available for that. Hopefully that's something we can discuss in the future when that solicitation opens up again. But in the meantime, we assist landowners with small projects on their property in order to conserve the resources. So perhaps there's an erosion concern. Perhaps you are interested in becoming a new farmer. Perhaps you are interested in some more progressive farming techniques. We can find grants that can fit what you plan on doing or help you develop those ideas.
And how are you funded?
Mainly grant funding at this point. Some resource conservation districts do receive a tax base. Ours does not. In that case, we seek grants. We seek willing partners for those grants. And then technical assistance is also something we can provide. So those are smaller contracts on a one-on-one basis. And really, there's quite a few different ways that funding can come into a resource conservation district. We're always willing to accept donations as well. So nobody's going to fight that.
Right. But you have enough money. Obviously, it covers your salary. Are other people work for it?
Yes. There are three full-time employees with the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. We have Devin Best. He's our executive director. We have Erin White. She's our deputy director.
Okay. And what's your job title again?
Program manager.
Okay. Got it. All right. And actually, we're here to talk about a specific program, and that is SWEEP, which stands for State Water Efficiency and Enhancement Program. So tell me all about SWEEP and what is it and what does it seek to do?
Sure. The SWEEP program is a granting program through the California Department of Food and Agriculture. There is a solicitation for this grant open right now. There have been, I believe, six previous solicitations, meaning that that gives landowners an opportunity to apply for a grant. It is a competitive grant program, and the current solicitation has $7 million available statewide. The maximum grant award is $100,000, so there's some pretty substantial work that can be achieved through these through this program. The main focus in this case is greenhouse gas reduction and water conservation on your property. Typically, we see projects that, in the case of water savings, could be irrigation scheduling improvement, weather, soil, and plant-based sensors, installation of micro-irrigation or drip systems. Those are quite popular in the case of the water savings. And then on the side of greenhouse gas reduction, we see a lot of pump conversion, improved energy efficiency of the pumps, perhaps low pressure systems developed, and variable frequency drives are also quite popular. In the case of all these things, there has to be a water savings and a greenhouse gas reduction verified in order for you to be a possible applicant.
And how do you measure a greenhouse gas? Give me a typical example. If I was a farmer, and what does that mean?
Sure. So part of the requirement for the solicitation requires that applicants are able to submit 12 previous months of energy use and or fuel receipts directly in order to show what they have been using previously. And then with whatever we can apply the funding to for your particular project, there is a program that has been developed on the application through the Air Resources Control Board that is a greenhouse gas reduction tool. So you input your particular information for whatever your project may be, and it will tell you what your planned savings would be.
Well, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Any downsides to this?
No, not really. We've seen quite a bit of success in our district in northern San Luis Obispo County through the SWEEP program in the years prior. Overall, statewide, we're seeing California Department of Food and Agriculture estimates that over 78,000 metric tons of CO2 will be reduced annually through the programs that have been accepted so far, as well as, and that's equivalent to removing over 16,000 cars from the roads for 1 year. That's quite a bit of greenhouse gas savings. Moreover, SWEEP projects will help save nearly 110,000 acre feet of water annually, and that's enough to fill over 50,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So there's quite a bit of savings that are available through these programs. On top of that, there is no cost share required for applicants, meaning that you don't have to really put any money towards any of these projects in order to receive a grant. Now, it's always recommended from a grant writing perspective to include a little bit of skin in the game. There are some points in the overall scoring system that allow for those folks with the CDFA who are going through the scoring on each applicant's
CDFA again?
Excuse me, the California Department of Food and Agriculture.
Oh, okay, right.
They're the grantor.
Okay.
They go through and score all the applications because this is a competitive grant program. And by proving that you have a little bit of skin in the game, you get an extra point. So that's worth noting.
Ah, got it. All right. Oh, okay, good. So can you give me some more concrete examples of, like, maybe some projects that were done last year or something like that?
Sure. And for any interested applicants, if you go to the CDFA website at cdfa.ca.gov, you can find previous applications that were successful for the SWEEP program to give you a bit of a template. Now, there is a template that you have to fill out in order to apply for this year's grant. Although it's always kind of nice to be able to bounce ideas off of other successful grants.
Yeah, that's always helpful to look at other examples. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, And that's something that we're here for as well. So our position at the Resource Conservation District is as a technical service provider. Now, there is also another Resource Conservation District in San Luis Obispo County. They are the Coastal San Luis Resource Conservation District. Their offices are in Arroyo Grande, but their main office is in Morro Bay. Their district is smaller, although it encompasses a lot of the population of San Luis Obispo County. So depending on your interest in these programs, please feel free to get a hold of either RCD. And depending on where you are located, we can direct you to the proper one. We have to work within our district boundaries, but we're always willing to offer information and assistance to anybody who comes knocking. That said, because we are in a position to provide technical assistance, we want to make sure that any applicant is putting together the best grant possible. And in order to put together the best grant possible, we'll give you great ideas on things that have been successful in the past. And so to answer your question, we see a lot of folks, especially in vineyard operations, upgrading their pumping systems. Typically, that's quite an expensive process, and this
it's an expensive process.
Yes,
okay.
And so the SWEAP program provides a lot of funding for folks to kind of jumpstart that program. Now, something to keep in mind with any of these CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture programs, is they are all kind of incentive programs. Their goal is to incentivize a change for the better, to reduce greenhouse gas or to save water on your property, just to conserve your resources, to improve your farming and agriculture techniques. They want to incentivize these programs through these grants in order to help change what is the norm. They really have done a great job through this SWEAP program and a Healthy Soils program to really begin watershed level changes. We're seeing quite a few interested applicants who may not have been interested in certain techniques before who are coming to us, and they're suddenly newly open-minded because perhaps their neighbors got involved with one of these programs and they're seeing success, whether that be in increased residual dry matter for ranchers or whether that be in increased forage for your cattle or sheep, or increased yields for your vines. There's a lot of positives that go into these programs.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. We're hearing a conversation about an agency in North San Luis Obispo County that offers grant programs to help farmers and vineyard owners. Let's get back to it. Here's Program Director Andrew Johnson speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart.
To get back again to some successful operations, in the case of vineyards, pump efficiency enhancement. So upgrading from a diesel pump to solar, perhaps. And that's a direction that a lot of people are looking to go, is to change over the energy for their pump systems to solar. And that's very popular, and I strongly suggest folks look into it. But you must keep in mind that along with that greenhouse gas reduction that will come from changing over to solar, you also need to have a water savings component. Those are the two requirements: greenhouse gas reduction and water savings component.
Oh, you have to have both.
Yes.
Okay, I thought it was one or the other. Okay, got it.
And as we spoke of before, the greenhouse gas reduction, there's an air resource control board algorithm that's built into the granting system, that's built into the website that you'd be using to fill out your grant anyway. That program exists as well as a water savings program. And based on my experience with them, they're both quite straightforward. They're very approachable programs that where you're just entering your historical use, information that should be readily available to any landowner or operator. And from that point, it will pump out a number, and that's the number you then enter into your application.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. All righty. And say I did have a diesel pump system and I went over to solar, I'd have to get some kind of storage, like batteries, right?
Yes.
So how does that work?
Well, there are several options. So this program will also support paying for that transition in order to take the solar and pump it back into the grid. That's something that we've seen on a lot of sites. Our RCD historically has been in place to do the on-site verification. Because we are a third party, we are neither the applicant nor are we the state. We are in a position to be a third-party verifier for CDFA to go on site after everything has been implemented, after all of the project has been implemented on site, and then take pictures and record data in order to send back to CDFA in the report saying, yes, everything's been done on site. And that is one part that I've seen quite a bit of, is the the infrastructure in place from the solar to be able to pump back into the PG&E system. So while there are some batteries on site that comes as part of the solar setup, you also can receive funding as part of this program to have the new system set up to pump back into PG&E, which is fairly common for most solar setups. They can pump back into the main grid.
Wow, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Okay,
it's a neat program. Yeah, we
cool.
agree.
Give me some other ones. What are some, besides a pumping system? What's like another example you've seen this program do?
Yeah. So again, solar is a really big part as far as the greenhouse gas savings go. Flow meters are very important. And now a flow meter goes on a pump to test exactly what I say, flow. It's gonna tell you exactly how much water is moving through your system. That is actually a requirement for all of these applicants. Because again, a water savings requirement is built into the grant program. This is the way to prove that water savings. So you might not have a flow meter installed already. Most people wouldn't if they're interested in these upgrades, but it is paid for through the grant. So whatever else you want to do, if you want to go from overtop irrigation to drip systems to micro sprinklers, and then you want solar involved with that as well, so you have your water savings and then you've got your greenhouse gas savings, you also must include the flow meter on your pump. Now that's something that's quite in vogue already, and if you're like me and you really like to keep track of all of your statistics and numbers, this is something that any good agriculturalist needs to be keeping very close track of. Water is a very precious resource in northern San Luis Obispo County, in all of California, clearly. So why wouldn't you be keeping very acute track of your numbers for your water usage? And right. So this program requires that you do.
Got it. Okay. All right. Very informative. Thank you. All right. Anything else that I have not asked you?
I just want to also include the important dates for the program. The solicitation is currently open. All grant applications are due December 16th of 2019. The awards will be announced sometime in the spring, and that's just kind of a floating date right now because CDFA hasn't released exactly when they'll be releasing the award announcement. The grant period, if you receive one of these grants, lasts from June 15th of 2020 through December 15th of 2021. It is an 18-month grant duration. Now, something to be sure to keep in mind is there is no reimbursement for funding spent prior to that June 15th commencement date, and there will be no reimbursement for funding after the December 15th deadline. So
you got to plan ahead. You got to, whatever work you're going to do, it's got to be between.
The work has to fall between June 15th of 2020 and December 15th of 2021. That duration is 18 months.
Wow, okay.
So
it's a pretty good long time.
It's a good long time, but these things do take quite a bit of time. Infrastructural changes are always going to be difficult. You're inevitably hiring contractors who need to be able to fit you into their schedule. It's important to keep in mind that this is a reimbursement program. The money will be spent by you prior to receiving the lump sum. So after that third-party verification occurs, once your entire upgrades have been completed, then you will be applying through CDFA for the remainder of your funding.
Got it. All right. So you got to have a chunk of change.
You do.
Front.
Yeah. You will be putting money down initially, but that is 100% reimbursable as long as it falls exactly within those dates and as long as it is only encompassing what you developed in your grant application.
So will you know that you will be reimbursed before spending the money?
If you have received a grant, it will tell you.
So it'll say, yes, you're going to get this grant.
Yes.
And then you spend the money, but you know you're going to get it back.
And there is a payment process, whereas I believe you can receive a certain percentage prior to the ending of the grant, but you'll receive the final allotment once everything has been third-party verified.
Got it. All mm-hmm. right. And that's part of your job?
Potentially. Again, we currently are on a small technical assistance grant from CDFA because we are on site. We've dealt with these programs before. But until the time comes in December of 2021, I mean, we'll know several months prior as to whether or not they'll be using RCDs as a third-party verifier again. We are currently a third-party verifier for the previous solicitation. So I assume that if everything follows suit, we'll be there again.
And since you have seen some of these in the past, or is there any pitfalls that you've noticed or?
Yeah, certainly. We have gone on site on a couple of occasions where the applicant believed they were complete or they believed they were close enough to ask for that third-party verification because, as you say, there's a fair chunk of change that you have to put down, and it'd be nice to not be out of pocket for so long. But till everything is 100% complete as per your grant, you will not be able to be third-party verified complete. Mm-hmm. So just make sure you've crossed all your T's and dotted all your I's, and then call us up, and or you will be notifying your grant manager with CDFA, and then they'll call us up, and then we'll come on site and do the verification.
Okay.
CDFA is a bit monolithic, but they are very helpful. So as long as you're willing to have some patience and understand that they have who knows how many number of projects in any given year that they're managing, everything will work out just fine.
Well, thank you for coming in and talking to me about this. Very informative.
Yeah, we really appreciate the opportunity. Anytime to get the word out about these really cool programs and about the RCD as well.
Hey, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
That was a conversation between KCBX News and Andrew Johnson, Program Director at the Upper Salinas Las Tablas Resource Conservation District. Greta and Andrew continue the conversation online, talking about other available grant programs, like one that focuses on healthy soils. Head over to kcbx.org, and we'll have the full interview posted shortly. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. A San Luis Obispo artist is working to try and get more jobs for artists in the community. Jamie Ray is the founder of Lamplight Arts Collective. It's a grassroots group of local independent artists working together to bring live art to San Luis Obispo and hopefully create paying gigs for Central Coast artists. I recently sat down with Ray to find out more about live art and the collective.
So it's just a group of independent artists that are working collectively together to sort of build camaraderie and create an industry standard for some of these jobs that we're trying to create in San Luis Obispo.
What led you to create this collective?
Mostly just seeing my friends struggle, my very creative, talented friends not finding ways to find work using their skills. So at the time I worked at a winery in Paso, and they allowed me to start hiring live painters. And we were gearing this like similar to the way they would hire musicians as live art entertainment. So you hire an independent artist, they come in and they do a live art demonstration. They interact with your guests and create a really cool experience. And it's worked. And in addition to that, we have paint bar instructors and art coordinators who can go in and do all the bookings, gather the artists and put them where you need them. So these are just a few of the jobs right off the top that we came up with. It's really exciting. You know, out there in Paso, you have this incredible luxury market where they're doing food and wine and music. And yeah, you throw a live painter in there and it adds something to the atmosphere. And the artists are able to go in and represent themselves and talk to people, meet their client base, work on their social skills, because that's something we all need as artists. You know, we spend many hours alone in our studios, and it's really healthy for us to get out there and find out what people think, you know?
So we could break down what live painting is. Do they come and paint a mural, or what is the live painting experience?
Let's start with, okay, so how do we usually see art? In galleries, finished, right? Or coffee shops. You're not really connected to the art maker or how it's made. That separates us. That's a long distance between where they see our art and where we began it. Setting up in a live in a place or a venue, you get to show people how it's made, the process. You know, if they're there for a few hours, they can see. You start a painting from scratch or bring something you're already working on. And what's really cool, as a viewer, you get to see this really vulnerable side of an artist where, you know, you get to see the mistakes that they make and you get to see us work through it. And it's challenging and it takes a lot of courage to get up there and do that. You know, it's like musicians. If you ever sat in a studio session, you know, it's many, many takes to the final perfect cut, right? Now, you get to, as a viewer, really appreciate the work that goes into the art. And also, I've heard people walking away from me like, oh, I could do that. Like, my kid could do that. And I've learned to take that as a win. If you see me in my progress, in my process, and think that you can do this too, good. Go do it. And that's what's really unique and cool about it. And we're engaging in really meaningful conversation. I paint about what it feels like to be me. And then someone meets me in that place, and we get to talk about what it feels like to be them. And this exchange happens, and it's really, it can end up in deep conversations. And whether or not I sell a canvas off the easel or give a little kid a nod where they're like, wow, there's somebody holding a place for artists in the world, you know, it's a win-win situation whether I sell something or not. Now, if the venue wants to pay me for my time there, that's excellent. That's what we're shooting for.
That's what we all want, is to get paid, right?
Right. Well, we got to make a living.
Well, I can tell you this. I promise to never come away from this experience and say I could do that. In a former life, I tried to go to school for photography, and I couldn't even pass design 101. So I do not have the skills. So I'm in awe of artists and what they do. But I guess you're right. It can make it more accessible for someone to see, oh, this is how that brush stroke is done,
right,
or this is how you put that together.
Yeah, they see us working through it, and there's an ongoing conversation that's happening while it's going, so it's very unique.
What kind of art do you make?
Like I said, I paint what it feels like to be me, so women's narratives. You know, my audience is very much connected to women. You know, I get people approaching me, and this is how I've learned who my audience is, through live art. The people that come and talk to me, they're like, oh, wow, you know, this is... It's hard to be human. It's hard to be a woman. And so I paint about those things in a symbolic way.
Arts are usually one of the biggest funding cuts across the board, you know,
yes,
in the United States. So what is the sell here to get people to invest in live art?
Right. So we want people to invest in mental health even when times are hard, right? And the arts are good for education for many reasons, and I could sell you on them, but how do we actually get the funding for it, right? There are very, very few pathways for artists to become, you know, productive members of society. You have art educators and administrators, both very under-supported roles in society, and don't really work in the focus on art making. So creating these jobs that will stimulate a pathway, creating a pathway, if we as art makers can march it to the line and say, these are the jobs that are available to artists, maybe we can shape the future of education. Because right now, why would we want to put our kids to the stupid hard job of becoming artists at this point? But I am one of the last generations that received art education in public school, and I don't know what my life would be without it. And so this is important for me to speak on, and exposing children to art making in schools gives them skills for creative problem solving, building independent narratives, processing their emotions, and communicating in a non-offensive, symbolic way with one another. These are crucial skills you need when times get hard. So can we put that as a priority? I get it, budget cuts. When somebody loses their job in my family, you know, it's like, do we still eat organic blueberries? Yes, because our physical health is important and it serves us down the line when times get even harder. So we just have to put our feet down and say what's important.
Well, you have some really admirable goals. What are some of the steps that you're putting into place to help achieve these?
Creating the jobs, that's part one. And that will help things trickle down to the education level, like I said. We can create a pathway. Some of the jobs that we're looking at are live art entertainers, wedding painters. We live on the Central Coast, which is a wedding destination. Any wedding planners or venues that do weddings and want to add a live artist to the mix, you know, that's an option. We have muralists. One of my favorites is an art companion. I have friends who work with special needs folks or senior citizens, where they go in and they do art stuff with the community, and that's a fantastic job. How do we connect the artists to these jobs, though, and to the places that want to hire them? My thoughts are, you know, modern technology, creating an online platform similar to Airbnb, where you have a two-user interface. where there's artists and profiles and you can filter them. And then you have private and public entities that are searching for artists, whether it be a mural or a wine label or whatever. You're looking local and you want to find your artist. Now, that's a long-term goal, and that would take a lot of funding, and I don't know how to do that by myself. So that's one reason why I'm doing this, is because if there are people listening who understand how to do that and want to work with me on that, I think that could create a up-to-speed relationship for artists and their potential employers. We're talking about a gig economy, which is coming up in our culture. But this would be more based locally, like you want someone to actually show up and do art for you in your home or business. So that's one avenue. And some of the barriers to that would be, right now, as it is, finding a job as an artist, you go through a local organization. And for public and or private entities to find an artist, they have to go through that organization as well, right? So there's a lot of red tape involved there, and it moves at the speed of, you know, molasses. A lot of artists are frustrated, and, you know, business owners that I talk to are frustrated because right now it's set up, if you're an employer, you submit an RFQ, right? An RFQ is a request for a quote or a request for proposal. Then your organization takes that and they submit a call for artists, okay? So then the artists come in and they submit proposals. And the guidelines for proposals are really specific. And if you get one little glitch wrong on that, the size of a JPEG, anything like that, you're tossed out. And you pour hours of your time into these submissions. I mean, your heart and soul, you're talking about it like this would be your life-saving opportunity to get to paint this mural. And yes, it'd be wonderful, but isn't there an easier route to connect these dots? So then, you know, the submissions come in and then the organization decides who should best fit this job. Now, that's a lot of work for everybody. And in our modern technology and the speed of things, employers don't want to wait that long. They don't want to haggle with a third party. And artists are like, we want to make art. We don't want to slave over submission proposals. So if we had an interface where employers could go on and see our job description, filter us by what they need, our ratings, like, you know, our previous jobs, what employers had to say about us, our gallery, our, you know, all of that in one application, it would cut through so much minutia. And ultimately, it's in the spirit of building an economy for artists that will trickle down to education. And, you know, so that's one of the bigger picture for me and where I see this could be huge.
Have you reached out to anybody in the San Luis Obispo tech community with your ideas?
No, I have not. And I'm kind of like a side door Sally. I'm here on KCBX just talking about it, and I would like to see what happens, you know?
Well, you have an event coming up, isn't that correct?
So yes.
If anyone's listening right now and wants to learn more, there's something coming up. I believe it's on December 5th.
December 5th. So the live art portion of this affects everything, too, on a large scale for our community. December 5th, the gracious CEO of Downtown SLO, Bettina Swigger, has given us Garden Street to take over and roll out our whole crew. We have Sun One Sound, which is our musical partner to Lamplight Arts Collective. So we're musicians and artists, all kind of fusion working together. And we'll be doing live art and music. And what this does is creates a scene, okay? And this has larger implications for what it means for the Central Coast on a larger picture. When I say that, there are roadblocks for artists selling art here. Most galleries want to sell paintings of oceanscapes. Not all artists fit into that category. And I don't blame the galleries. Like, that's what the tourist economy wants. They want to take home a pretty picture of the ocean. But if we can make a scene and create another reason for tourists to come here, like growing a larger collective of artists that are coming out and participating in the community And it's like, yeah, spend a day at the beach, but come see what's happening in downtown SLO with the live art. It's like an underground circus. And maybe we walk that and we march that to the line of the galleries and we're like, hey, look, not everybody's here to buy a landscape painting. They want really interesting art too. And also the collectors of San Luis Obispo, they might, you know, tip their hat at us and say, maybe I don't need to go to San Francisco or LA to buy a good piece of art. Maybe I just walk downtown.
And for anyone listening, the Downtown Farmers Market in SLO is a really large event every Thursday in Garden Street, where you're going to be, is a lovely little side avenue. How many people will be involved in this?
So we have the musical side. We'll have roughly, I'm guessing, 5-6 musicians all plugged into a giant sound installation. And they do experimental jazz. And then we have about 20 live artists as of right now who are going to be set up doing pop-up gallery, representing themselves and talking to people. And we've labeled it a penny gallery because we really hope people buy some things. It's a lot of work for us to, in 30 minutes, as it is for every vendor at Farmers Market, to pop up an experience for the community. So if you're holiday shopping, you know, whatever you're doing out there, yes, we would love for you to be entertained, but we also would like you to have the opportunity to buy some art from us. So we're lowering our prices for that night.
What time will this be going on?
6 to 9 p.m.
So if anyone wants to get more information or get involved or help you launch that app, mm-hmm. how can they get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
I do. JamieRayArt.com is my website. And Lamplight Arts, you can follow me on Instagram. There's Lamplight Arts on Instagram and message me there. So those are a couple of options. Also, come see us on December 5th and talk to me in person. That's really the best way.
Jamie Ray, founder of Lamplight Arts Collective in San Luis Obispo, thank you so much for coming in, and I wish you the best in this endeavor.
Thank you so much for having me, Tyler.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. In case you're wondering, the music is Crack the Walnut by Roger the Shrubber. When driving up Highway 101 at San Ardo at exit 363, there is a huge grove of bushy trees lining the east side of the highway. That grove started intriguing me on my trips to the Bay Area, particularly when the leaves went from green to a shimmering white, and their white-barked trunks. I had a hunch of what kind of trees they are, but I couldn't find anything online about them. Then, through my ecclesiastical network, I contacted a farmer who is a parishioner at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in San Ardo, who confirmed my hunch that the grove is walnut trees, and he knows the growers. So I spent some time with Gordon and Vicky to learn more about their 27,000 walnut trees.
My name is Gordon Rosenberg, and I do as little as I can get away doing.
But you grow walnuts.
Well, Tomas and I learned together. Neither one of us had anything to do with walnuts, and he's worked for me most of his adult life, and we just learn as we go.
Okay, how long have you been growing walnuts?
Well, you planted them in 1967, the first orchard.
So, 52 years.
Yeah.
Okay. 52 years. Yeah, it's a long time. What does it take to grow walnuts?
A lot of time. Takes years and years. It's a long-term deal. It's a lifetime program. And then for me, it was really interesting because we have to do our own harvesting and our own hulling, and we had to design and build a plant to handle the walnuts. And when we're harvesting, we can harvest 100,000 pounds each day. Wow. After day after day.
That's a lot. What is required to grow walnuts?
Soil that's good enough to grow trees on, and water, and climate that's just right. I planted walnuts and they grew good, and I didn't go didn't study anything in school about walnuts. I planted some. They were vigorous. When I planted my orchard, people usually go out and buy little seedlings about 3 feet tall. I had land and water, and I was tight on the cash, and I put seeds in the ground.
Just a raw walnut?
Yeah.
You just took a raw walnut, you stuck it in the ground, and it grew.
They grow. They're seeds. Before I put it in the ground, I had a called a walk-in box for, like, if you kill a steer or something, it's cold, you know? And I went to the lumber yard and got, they had a lot of sawdust I didn't want. And I put that in the walk-in box, and I mixed it with walnuts and wet it down with water. And that kept the walnuts nice and damp. Pretty soon, out of the end, a little white shoot would grow. And they just took off. And then when they were ready to grow, then I took them and put them out. And I didn't know whether to put two or three or how many. And then I put four or five in each spot. I had a lot of walnuts. And then I wasn't certain whether, if you got walnuts up, like say a foot or two tall, is it better to take them all out but one, save the biggest one, or leave them in where they're competing against each other? And I discovered somehow my choice was to leave them all in as a bunch. They grow more vigorously than one would by itself out in the wind and sun and all. And then later on, I eventually, of course, cut them all. You only have one tree in one spot.
So there's like more than like 27,000 trees overall. Some of them were planted, like you said, as a seed, and some of them were a seedling that then got grafted to the variety that he wanted.
You've been doing this for 52 years, and you've got 27,000 trees, more than 27,000 trees. You have different varieties. Now, we don't think of walnuts having different varieties because we go to the store, we buy a bag of walnuts, yeah. We make our cake, yeah. And that's it. So how many varieties of walnuts do you have?
Two. Ashley and Chandler, they got ripe one first ahead of the other one. What are you going to do if they all get ripe at the same time? So that was the thing that I found out, oh, this variety was earlier and this other variety was later, so I planted my fields that way. We start in the first part of October with our first harvest. By the time we get done with the first variety, the second variety is ripe and ready for harvest.
What's the taste difference between the two varietals?
The Ashleys have a tendency to have a little more flavor than the Chandlers.
But they're not as pretty looking.
But the Chandlers are a lighter color. They're better on the market to be light. Some people look at the Ashleys and they're a darker color and they think, oh, that's not good. But so that's a marketing.
We want pretty food. We want, right. Yeah, perfect carrots.
Yep. Perfect walnuts.
Well, is it possible to go see the walnuts in all of their glory?
I'm happy to drive you around. I guess Vicky will get in this here. Yeah.
With over 27,000 trees, the plantation is quite big. The tour included the shop where the equipment is located, the processing plant, and of course, the trees themselves.
So do you still have your original trees?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'll show them to you. Right out in front of our house. See these up here? These walnut trees?
Mm-hmm.
These are the original ones.
And are they still producing as much as they were originally?
We get big, huge crops. I think they go up and down each year, depending on the weather, maybe. You don't see any walnuts on the trees. And you don't see any walnuts on the ground. And that's what makes me happy, because we've already harvested. I had a friend and his wife that were here, and we were going to give them some walnuts. And they said, oh, we'll just go out in the orchard where you already harvested and pick up the ones you missed. And they came back after about 35 minutes, and they had the 6 or 7 walnuts.
That's a pretty good job.
You can't harvest until the hull dries up and will drop off easily. That's what makes us wait. For the hull, by Mother Nature, in the beginning, they're part of the shell. And then they loosen up, they'll even split open a little bit, and they'll loosen up from being stuck to the shell, because we have to be able to separate the hull off the shell. That's when they're ready to harvest, when that'll happen.
And then you just leave the hull on the ground and it fertilizes the soil?
We have piles and piles, so we have a spot where we can go dump it. It's worthless. These two walnuts are ready for harvest. See how the hull's coming off? See how it separates? Mm-hmm. But you have to wait for the ones like this. They don't all ripen at the same time. So you have to wait for these, because if you shake the tree, those will fall and these won't. They just stay on the tree. Then you have to come back a second time. So we wait and do it all in one time, and we go really fast. Get a lot of equipment and do it one time instead of harvesting twice. You can see here on this tree here, a lot of them are open, but there's some that aren't, and they're not ready. And I don't want to shake these loose and then have to come back in 2 weeks again. I want to wait a week or two and then do it all at once.
Yeah. Can I go over here and look at these ones on the ground? Oops, I just stepped on a walnut.
See the difference up there? That is because of blight.
One that's half black and half green.
Yeah. That particular walnut has a blight from the rain. It's like a spore. See, like some of the walnuts are okay and some of them are not. The hull didn't protect the nut, so it's like the nut has died inside.
So it's really about the green hull splitting perfectly and showing the tan-colored or walnut-colored shell.
Yep.
We tasted some of the walnuts right off the tree.
If you ate it now, what would it taste like?
It's bitter, and it tastes kind of funny on your tongue. Does it taste kind of funny on your tongue?
Tastes a little bit funny. It's not bitter.
It still has moisture in it. So when it goes through the drying process, then the moisture comes out. We have to dry them to 8% or less before we ship them. So if you keep a lot of moisture in it and ship them over 8%, and when they go to the handlers, then it ends up that they've got too much moisture and they sweat.
Back in the car, we headed for the production end of the walnut growing industry with a few more things about managing the grove along the way.
The leaves are different on different trees.
Oh, we sprayed for sunburn?
So this spray goes on there so the leaves don't get sunburned.
Yeah.
And not only for the leaves, it's also for the walnut.
Right, the walnut itself.
So, all been sprayed because they're along the road where they sunburn.
So you sprayed just the ones along the road, so the ones inside the grove are more protected?
Yes, that's correct.
See the sunlight here and there in the orchard? If you let the trees keep growing, it's all shaded, and then your walnut production drops way off. When I was getting ready to plant walnut trees, they had a walnut day up in a different area, and I went up there. I saw this guy's orchard, and it was with big trees, and he had on from the top down about 8 or 10 feet was a lot of walnuts. It was all shaded, no leaves down low. It didn't look like this. All over these trees where you see leaves, they bear walnuts there where the leaves are. And this other guy's orchard, it was all just bare trunks up high.
Then we saw and heard some of the equipment.
That's a sweeper with a blower on the back of it, and this up here is a shaker. This is the part that clamps onto the tree trunk. If you guys want to get out and see it.
Yeah, I'll take a look.
Them out in the middle, and the blower blows them across so that where the tree row is, so when you come back the other direction, your sweeper can pick them up. They sweep so you don't run over walnuts. This clamp's closed and then starts vibrating, and then the tree limb starts shaking. And if the walnuts are ripe, they'll fall off and drop on the ground. We wait until we can shake them all in one shake.
Okay.
I'll let one or two walnuts on, but not 20 to a tree. I wait longer.
The sweeper just went over there.
There's your shaker. Then there's the harvester over there. I don't see the sweeper.
The sweeper's over there.
Over there.
Getting gas.
Oh, there's a sweeper. On the left is a harvester.
And that goes and picks up the walnuts?
The sweeper puts them in a row about 3 feet wide and about 6-8 inches in the middle tall, a big row. It's got leaves, a few sticks in it. And then the harvester picks them up and fills these carts. Well, there's a cart behind the harvester now.
Okay, and it looks like there's a grate on the top to keep big sticks from going in.
Exactly, yeah. The sticks, yeah. He just drives right over here and drops them down in there. That's open. And then they go up there, and they go into a blower. I'll go around the other side here. That's our runoff water. It's got water down in the bottom because that's our water level.
Okay, so they go in a big hole, and then they go up that conveyor belt. And when they get into this machine, what happens to them?
They come up the elevator, and then that tan-colored machine has a big blower on it. And it blows leaves or little branches and stuff out. And then they come down below it as a shaker. And we're separating the stuff we don't want from the walnuts. And then the walnuts come up and fall into a big roller thing with spaces. And they roll and all the little stuff drops out through the bottom and goes into the garbage. We used to have a little platform and 10 ladies working on it that handpick bad stuff out. And now we have an electric eye that sees them and goes in the air, blows the bad walnut out. So we don't have 10 ladies working for us anymore.
And then from this machine, where do they go?
Well, first of all, they have to get dried. So over here, it takes the hull off and also separates the bad walnuts out. So we just have good walnuts coming up the elevator into the dryer. And the dryer, see those squares of plywood? Mm-hmm. We used to have little dryers stacked out here. You had to move them from one dryer for two bins with two openings on each bin. Then we were able to get one great big dryer. So we have down here two great big dryers in the back. They blow down from below those square boards. It's all an open chamber, and there's holes in the bottom, so we can adjust them each. There's six bins, and the reason we have six bins together is because that's one truckload, and that's how we ship them. So we got two of those rows, so we can fill them each day, dry them during the afternoon and night, and then move them to that hopper around the other side that's up high. Then all we have to do when the truck arrives is he drives underneath and we pull the gate open and the walnuts just flow the loaded truck, the whole truck, in about 20 minutes. See that weight?
Yep.
But we just take that off and pull the lever out and they just flow into the truck and fill it in a hurry. We can fill a truck up in, I think it's 20 minutes.
And from there, they end up all over the world.
Wherever they go.
What do you do the 9 months of the year when you don't have to harvest?
There's all kinds of jobs for the crew. Mowing and spraying and irrigating, pruning.
When you say pruning, obviously trees do better when they're pruned, right? We all know about pruning. So you have to prune every single one of these 27,000 trees every year?
Pretty much.
We're always doing something.
This simple nut, which is everywhere, in every type of dish, and easy to find and to eat, actually requires a lot of work to produce. Just the orchard itself is an investment. Every one of them, from saplings to the 57-year-old trees, requires care and attention. Then there's the harvesting, the sorting, and the drying. All that happens before they even get processed for packaging and distribution. There was one thing I was curious about, though. Vicky shared with me the innovations in the walnut growing industry.
So this shows you the different applications. These are all walnut shells.
And then this?
Well, it shows you Like it says, blasting, microblasting, polishing, and it's according to, see these different, see like 0119, you'd look up that number, and then this particular grind of the walnut shell would then be used for these things over here.
So the shells are being used as abrasives. The different grinds or particle sizes or mesh sizes have specific applications, like blasting, cleaning, polishing, and filtration. The shells are crushed, ground, and classified to standard mesh sizes. The company whose grinds Vicky showed me has a huge array of uses for walnut shells, including exfoliants in cosmetics and soaps, fillers in paint, resins, plywood, adhesives, ceramics, dynamite, tile, and livestock feed, decoration in molded plastics, water filtration, bedding and cage liner for household birds and pets, and some sort of use in the oil industry that I didn't quite understand from the description. That's all pretty cool. After the grand tour of the walnut plantation in San Ardo, I decided that I couldn't play with food in my kitchen in any sort of unique way with walnuts. They are enjoyed in every type of food, from salads and smoothies to baked appetizers and cheese platters to hummus and vegetables, pizza and tacos to tea balls and baklava. Walnuts even feature in cocktails and lattes. There was nothing more interesting that I could do in my kitchen than you could find in a standard cookbook, never mind an extensive web search. But Gordon? He's got the key to consuming walnuts.
You've been growing walnuts for 52 years. Surely you save some for yourself.
Well, we don't buy what we eat from the grocery store. Yeah, I mean, they go on cookies and cakes. They go on ice cream.
Well, and what's your advice that you say? To eat 12 walnuts a day keeps the doctor away?
Oh, well, it's just a phrase I have because I'm pretty old and I'm very healthy. And why not attribute it to walnuts? Why not? Can't argue against it.
There you go. 12 walnuts a day keeps the doctor away. The Central Coast continues to prove that we can produce everything we could ever desire. So get yourself a bag of California walnuts, make some baklava, some vegan walnut meatloaf, or simply sprinkle some toasted walnuts onto a huge scoop of Central Coast-made ice cream. And with the apple walnut muffin recipe from the California Walnut website, perhaps you can keep the doctor away forever. This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Issues and Ideas will be on break next Monday. We hope you have a great Thanksgiving holiday. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more local stories. In the meantime, you can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.